Welcome to Fright School. Are you ready? Class is in session.
Welcome back to Fright School. Hello, Joe.
Hi, Joshua.
That was an entertaining pre-show, whatever that was
before pre-record. Our mic check.
We got a little bit of Touched by an Angel.
Yes.
We got some Paris is Burning.
Paris is Burning, and you know,
it's great. Yeah,
I did my Della Reese impression.
Yeah. Poor listener, you don't get to hear all this stuff that happens before we hit record.
No,
it's quite something.
You know, we'll release it as special features later, and
yeah, on the DVD exactly. Bonus release,
the bonus DVD.
Features, extra features.
Yeah, we'll do it that way.
Additional content,
Patreon content.
There we go, Patreon content, because yeah. we have a Patreon. We don't. That's not true.
Not yet.
But we do have a tip jar, and you can follow us and rate and subscribe and all of those things.
Yeah, give us that money.
But other than that, what's going on? What have you been doing this week? Have a good week?
I did have a good week. We took a holiday. We took our school holiday off.
We did.
And I had a very lovely week. I went with my special man friend. We went to watch a Broadway singer sing the love songs of Broadway at the symphony.
And who was that?
Norm Lewis.
Oh, yeah.
With Emily Skinner. Emily Skinner was in the original, was with Alice Ripley in Sideshow, where they played.
Oh, yeah, where they played the twins.
They played the conjoined
Violet
twins.
And...
Yes.
I know their story.
Yeah, you know, that's all that matters, is that you know their story. You may not know their names.
We need to share their story. That's a story that needs to be told.
Yeah.
And has been, obviously, in Sideshow. Anyways, in musical form. Yeah, that's very important.
So he did, he did it. You would have loved it. He did Music of the Night, and he has a very beautiful baritone.
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah. But yeah, so did that, and that's it. I'm really, really getting excited for some trailers that I've been seeing. Spiral.
Yeah. The new, what is it, from the Book of Saw?
From the Book of Saw,
yeah.
Yes. Spiral.
I'm excited for that.
Excited for that. I kind of want to see Fantasy Island.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I meant to look that up because I saw a trailer for it, but I haven't paid any attention to it. Because when I first saw that it was being made, I just assumed it was like an adaptation of like the show.
Yes, sort of. I think it's sort of an adaptation from the show. But
I just thought it was.
Oh yeah, because they have totally Michael Pena as like the Ricardo Montalban figure.
Oh, okay.
And he welcomes them all to Fantasy Island, but like the fantasies are twisted.
Huh.
Yeah.
Well, maybe we'll see it anyways. Is that from Blumhouse?
It is from Blumhouse. Yeah. I support anything with Maggie Q, so she's in it, and I love her.
Okay, cool. Yeah. I it was something else we were talking about. The Hunt. They're finally releasing.
Yes, The
yes,
Hunt.
Finally. I love Blumhouse's like poster that was going around on Fangoria and stuff. It was like
most controversial movie you've never seen.
That you've never seen. Yeah. I was like, oh, this is fun. And then all the quotes of, like, how horrible it is and nobody should see it. I'm like, this is brilliant marketing.
Oh, yeah. They just, lean into it, right?
Yeah. And I like that Betty Gilpin.
Yeah, Betty Gilpin from Glow.
Yeah, from Glow. I like her a lot.
So. I was really bummed when they didn't release it. I mean, I understand. But I also was bummed when they didn't release it because I really, like, Betty Gilpin is supposed to be really good in this.
Yeah, I'm very excited by it. I was listening to her give a talk. Or not give a talk. It was an interview with Marc Maron on his What the Fuck podcast or WTF with Marc Maron.
Yeah.
And she talked a little bit about it and how it's always sucks, you know, to have made something and to have liked it. Now it can't do anything, you know. Mm-hmm. So I'm excited that it'll be out there.
Yeah. And we've talked about it on the show before where it's like this, you know, you've already made the thing. And instead of having deeper conversations about gun violence or violence in general, people think that like, oh, we should just not put this out.
Yeah, no, I think it's completely ridiculous. It's just false, like, righteous and self-righteousness or something. I don't know what to call it. It's just, it's very, you know, it's like the same, like people were like pearl clutching about like the Super Bowl show, you know, it's
gosh,
these women, it's, and it's like, while at the same time, these are probably the same kind of people that are marching their daughters into these like beauty pageants, you know, all glitzed and glammed up, you know, or the same people who are like sexualizing, you know, kids on the Disney Channel, you know what I mean? It's like, you know, I mean, these people that are like Millie Bobby Brown is like the sexiest person alive or so. It's like, what the fuck? She's like 13 or 14 years old, you know? So it's just all false, like hand-wringing bullshit.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, also like think about a couple things, right? Think about the fact that there's like the cheerleaders, like Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders are wear less than what J-Lo and J-Lo and Shakira wore.
Yeah, very true.
And also, I mean, like...
I guess, I've never seen them, but I assume that's true.
It's true. And like, also, let's face it, like, the NFL is already kind of garbage because of all of... I mean, watch the Aaron Hernandez documentary and you'll know. Like, it's...
Well, yeah, but... And of course, all, like, the wife beating and, like, you know, all
exactly.
of, like, the horrible, like, things that these guys have done. And then they, you know, still get to be paid millions of dollars to, you know, chase a ball around in tight pants.
Yeah.
You know, so...
There's no real protection for them either, given with all of the concussion, traumatic
brain
injury.
Yeah. So then on the other side. Yeah, of course. Yeah, of course.
So...
Yeah, it's very frustrating, you know, just the, and horror always kind of gets, you know, the short end of the stick. And it's like this, we make horror to reflect stuff in society that we should be talking about, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's like, if we need to have a conversation, we shouldn't be stopping films from being put out in there so we can have the conversation. But again, it's just, it's nonsense, you know, it's just false. It just makes people feel good that they, you know, were mad about something.
Yeah.
It's misplaced rage, you know, instead. Yeah. And it's like, well, no, I mean, I don't want guns to, you know, be controlled. I just don't want this film where people get shot to death. You know what I mean? It's like, that can't happen. But, you know, children getting shot with guns, that's not the problem. That's not what we should be talking
about. Oh, yeah,
about.
That's the thing. Is that like, oh, let's not release, to be sensitive to people's, you know, to be sensitive to people's sensibilities, for lack of a better word, let's not release this. But, you know, let's also not do any comprehensive, any good comprehensive legislation or conversation about what it means.
You know, and you also have the choice not to go. Like, that's the thing. Like, I have a choice not to go see The Hunt or to go see, you know, whatever movie is out there. But we don't get a choice that some guy or some person, you know, took away walking into a school and shooting a bunch of children. Like, we didn't get a choice in that, you know? So it's like...
You can say guy. It's mainly guys.
Well,
it's mainly men.
Mainly is white men with misplaced toxic rage, masculinity, bullshit stuff. Anyways... you cannot go see a movie, you know, you cannot watch a TV show. You can turn those things off. You cannot read books. You can choose not to engage with this,
with the material,
with the material, with this cultural exchange. But, you know, we didn't get a choice in this horrific thing happening. And so we're focusing, you know, on the wrong thing. And again, and I kind of get that to some degree because like the psychology of it, of like people can feel like they can be in control of that. And you can get 1,000 people together and sign a petition and, you know, and go after, you know, Paramount or whoever, you know, making a movie and getting it pulled that could give you some sense of control, of power over the situation, but it's just going to keep happening when we're having the wrong conversations.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, anyways, all of that was to say that The Hunt's coming out finally. So go see it. Support Betty Gilpin, if nothing
Gilpin.
Else.
Hillary Swank.
Oh, right, yeah. I'm very intrigued by it, so I definitely want to see it.
Oh, field trip soon. Listener.
Yes, exactly. What else I've been watching? Speaking of child killings, I've been watching The Outsider on HBO.
Okay.
It's a well, I mean, that's what it's about.
Is that the thing that I've seen?
Jason Bateman,
Ben Mendelsohn,
mm-hmm.
And Cynthia Erivo?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. What's it about?
Well, I don't want to give too much away. I don't want to spoil too much of that because the show's not over yet, so it's still going. I think we're on episode 8 of 12 or 13.
Okay.
So Stephen King, it was based on a novel that he wrote, and he was obsessing over this idea about how somebody could be in two places at once. And so that's what it's about. It's about this, this horrible child killing happens. Jason Bateman's character, this is in the first episode, is accused of this like horrific, brutal, murder, rape of this like 11-year-old boy. And they show like a little bit of his body. It's like horrifying, like bitten, like mauled, like he's been mauled by a wild animal, but it's a person. And so they're like, they've got everything. They've got DNA evidence. They have fingerprints. They have people that saw him wandering about town doing different things covered in blood. But they also have video footage of him 60, 70 miles away in another town at a conference. So it's like, how can both things be true? And so that's sort of what kicks off the narrative. And oh, so then as it goes,
intrigue. You know,
yeah, it's a bit, it does remind me, it's a bit of a long, like, X-Files episode in a way, you know, which I like. That's a good thing, you know, not at all to take away from it. You know, it's just that that's what it gives me. So if you like the X-Files, it has a little bit of that, you know, so some of that vibe of like, you're going wrong. Like, well, yeah, what the fuck is going on here? Like, how is... Like, there's footage, and then he's also there, and they kind of are showing these different, like, people's memories of interacting with him. And, yeah, so it's very interesting kind of how it's been going along. I like it so far.
Okay.
I worry about the ending, as I always do with Stephen King stuff, so we'll see how the it wraps up.
Have you read the book, or what?
No, I have not. Yeah, no, I have not. I kept thinking that I would, but I have so many books I'm trying to read right now, so I thought I'll just enjoy the show. And if I do... end up really liking it, maybe I'll go back and read it.
Okay.
You know, I think it's pretty short, so it probably would be a quick read, but I'm just reading so much right now. I just picked up a bunch of new stuff, so I need to get caught up on all that first.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. I was trying to think if there's anything other, like, horror movies or anything I saw this week.
You saw Birds of Prey.
I did. We talked about that, I think, on the last episode. I rewatched a movie that maybe we should do for this show. I don't know. I don't know if you've ever seen it with Ashley Judd.
Along Came a Spider?
No, oh. Bug.
Oh, the play. It's based on a play. Yeah.
It is based on a play.
It's Ashley Judd and Patrick Wilson?
No, Michael Shannon.
Michael Shannon. Okay.
Yeah, I rewatched that, and I'm like, if we don't do it this year, we should do it next year for our, like, Tainted Love month.
Fair. That's fair.
Yeah, it's a very it's a very interesting movie, and I rewatched it over the weekend. Just cuz I really like it. I think it's a really good movie. Okay. So, and but it's also one of those movies that sort of, you know, I think, like, it's 50-50. You know, probably has, like, a 5 out of 10 score. You know, either people really like it or they really hate it. But it has some incredible acting from Ashley Judd and Michael Shannon. They're just, you know, it's really good. So nothing new. That was just something older that I was like, you know, I want to rewatch this movie. It'd be fun.
Okay.
other than that, not much else going on. You know, just busy school.
Busy schooling.
Working.
Schooling and working and living and learning.
Exactly. Writing, doing a ton of writing because I'm in this writing class.
Good.
Yeah, yeah. It's been a lot of fun dealing. Dating back, like, finding old memories and stuff, that's kind of what we're in right now. It's a creative nonfiction class, so we're focusing a lot on memory. So I'm, like, digging up stuff that, you know, it's like you kind of forget about things. And then, I don't know, some interesting stuff's been coming to the surface for me lately. So it's like I'm doing this, like, psychotherapy through writing.
Ooh.
So I really like the class, and yeah. I'm hoping by the end of it, I have a lot of pieces that I can maybe put out into the world.
Oh,
some
good.
Stuff that's been...
That's good for you. Good.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yay.
What about you? Anything, any good, any news, anything happening?
No, nothing new. Nothing. I mean, just, you know, working and getting ready to release another show, which I can't really talk about, but, you know, we'll... When it's finally released, we'll talk about that then.
And yeah.
Yeah, I'm just enjoying.
I'm excited for you, Joe. You're so busy.
I'm excited.
She's doing all the things.
I'm doing all the things, school. All the things.
Man. Well, that's a nice little teaser for our listener of something that they can hopefully turn their earballs into.
Hold on, I can't believe we didn't talk about this. The RuPaul's Drag Race Season 12 trailer came out.
I know, we're going to have RuPaul's Drag Race episodes to recap very soon.
Oh, God. And she got all the guests.
She did. There's a lot of guests. I don't know how I feel again. I watched, like, the runway thing where they were introducing all the girls. They all have the same face. Mm-hmm. You know, pretty much, except the one that has Trixie Mattel's face. I think we talked about that on another episode, maybe. I mean, it'll be cool to see the judges. I mean, they got AOC on there. They got Robin. They got, Chaka Khan.
They got Chaka Khan. They got, they have, Leslie Jones.
Yeah, Leslie Jones. That's right. I'm very excited about her being on the show.
Rachel Bloom is in there. Yeah, it's going to be good.
Yeah. I'm excited to see kind of what happens.
Nicki Minaj.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Nicki Minaj.
Yeah. Yeah. No, they definitely pulled out all the stops. I mean, hey, go them. It's just, I don't know. I'm very frustrated with the state of, like, drag and drag race. You know, this mainstreaming of drag that's happening where it's becoming so one note, you know? So we'll see. I mean, that's just early me being cynical, probably. We'll get in there and I'll start to see the differences in the girls and what, you know, and all that. But, you know, watching the UK, RuPaul's UK did, it's just like, I mean, everybody just seems
homogenous.
They're getting all their stuff from YouTube. These are girls that who have now have, you know, grown up on Drag Race and they're inspired by these girls. So we're just seeing these archetypes emerge each year, you know, where you can kind of see there's a Sharon Needles, there's a Jinx Monsoon, there's a Trixie Mattel, there's a, you know.
Yeah, nothing quite beats like those first five seasons of Drag Race where they establish the archetypes and.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I just want it to be more dangerous, I guess. I want to see some more, you know, I want to see some of like the Tranimals. I want to see like the bearded queens. I want to see some drag kings. You know, I want to see, you know, especially after Dragula. I mean, Dragula really brought it this last year and introduced the world to some just really incredible, you know, artistic creatures, you know, just doing something with drag that's, you know, beyond looking pretty, you know.
Yeah.
So I don't know. We'll see. I mean, I don't want to like piss all over like I have now done. I'm going to watch, you know, like every other queer.
Well, what's
you know?
Good to look forward to is that, you know, my special man friend does not have any experience with the drags.
I know.
So now you can, I offer him up as tribute for you to, you know, relive your love through him again.
Yeah, but I wouldn't want to start there. So,
well, not there. We got to all the way.
Well,
we got to all the way back.
So we have to. Yeah, we're gonna have to. We got to arrange.
We'll
we
just
gotta,
do the best, the 10 best episodes.
We can do that, but we also are gonna have to get a little Paris is Burning in there and some
wig stock,
Priscilla Queen of the Desert,
Tu Wong Fu.
That it's we definitely can do it. It's not like on the very top.
Yeah,
I've
but
got
it's
a few others.
The battle.
Know. Yeah, the Queen. Mm-hmm. There's some other like foundational texts.
Ah, yes.
And that's just like,
and that'll
stuff
be Patreon
become
content. We will release, right. You know. Drags.
We should start
a
drag race show. Like,
oh,
just,
my
oh
God.
My gosh.
Join everyone else with a drag race show.
Right.
Yes.
Alrighty. Well, yeah. So that'll be fun. We do have that to look for. If nothing else, it's always a joy to hang with you and watch the show. And,
yes, it is.
You know.
Yes, God, the house down boots. Okur.
All right. And with that, we'll be right back to discuss Fatal Attraction.
Hey, everybody.
What's up?
I'm here, too.
We are the Jersey Ghouls, a horror podcast based out of the Garden State. Join us on Jersey Ghouls for Marissa's scholarly conversations.
By the way, if you Google Psycho Female, you definitely don't get the name of the actress from Psycho. Join us on Jersey Ghouls for Nate's thrilling debate.
Why are you so resistant against
because
it?
Because don't you start.
Join us on Jersey Ghouls for Jackie's love of 80s slasher movie Topless Scene.
Whoa, Jackie, this is a feminist podcast.
I know. I'm a woman. And as a woman, I appreciate a nice set of jugs.
Okay, but you shouldn't call them jugs.
Hooters? Bazungas? Tatas? Dirty pillows?
I like boobs too.
Can I call them fun bags?
No! We're the Jersey Ghouls. You can find us on social media by searching Jersey Ghouls on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, SoundCloud, and iTunes. You can also find our blog and podcast on our website, jerseyghouls.com.
Ah, and we are back. And Joe, you're never gonna date again, right? After seeing that,
no.
Well, you're definitely not gonna date any women.
No, definitely not dating any women. Oh god!
And hopefully your friend won't either.
Yes, my special man friend.
Special man friend. All right. So yes, we are back to continue our series in Tainted Love.
Tainted Love.
With 1987's Fatal Attraction, directed by Adrian Lynn, and starring Michael Douglas, Glenn Close, Ann Archer. We have names. I kept trying to remember where I knew Ann Archer from besides this film, and it finally hit me. She plays the mother of Dee and Dennis Reynolds in It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Oh.
And she's wonderfully horrible.
Oh, so, good for her.
Like, she's like this horrible mother, and I love that juxtaposition, knowing that she's like famous for this film, you know,
for
as
being
well.
A good mother?
This good mom, yeah, who loses her child and then drives her car into somebody else. It's so irresponsible. Anyways, so film, you know, quick rundown. It's about a married guy who tries to have a quick little fling and pays the price for that. So, Joe, what'd you think?
Yeah, this this film was a journey.
It was a journey.
It was super 80s, which I loved, and it was also such a journey because it really does like have that like slow building crescendo toward madness.
Yeah.
But yeah, and super 80s again, just, you know, just a cultural fascination with Japan. And
yeah, you know, you brought that up and I thought that was really interesting and it made me kind of go back and I was looking for some articles about that, you know, so to have a little sidebar here, because I was thinking about some other films around this time that came out that kind of have that same, one of the Poltergeist movies, I think, came out around either late 80s, early 90s. It's like where they're in this giant apartment skyscraper. It's part three. And there's this whole fascination with the fact that they're going to this party and they're going to have sushi, you know? And it's like, you know, and so it's like displayed out and it's all gorgeous looking. And, you know, so that like, the whole thing when they're going to like the book signing in the beginning of this movie,
very
Fatal Attraction.
It's like the Nippon modern, like it's like, I don't know if that, I just coined that phrase.
Did you?
Please, you know, cite me when you use it. It's just because it's like black lines, which black and lines and tile and all that stuff. But then it's still like Japan and over like kimonos, but like futuristic looking. And then that not 2 years before we have Back to the Future, who Marty McFly says, like, you know, all the best things are made in Japan. So it's like this over, I think at the time was as Japan enters the marketplace with cars and things like that. And
what's so interesting, because only, you know, 40 years before, you know, we had like Japanese internment camps, you know, there was this massive like fear of this Japanese invasion here in America. So to see it in such a short time, like turn around, largely I think due to like business to like the Japanese in the 80s were just buying everything, you know, were, you know, buying up, you know, businesses here in America. They were coming here and, you know, forging all these deals. Suddenly, you know, you do have like the cars, like Toyota and
Datsun. Yeah, yeah.
And then of course, you know, I mean, it's like, it's so sneaky, you know, this like invasion, you know, that everybody's like talking about like, oh, the Japanese are going to try to invade us. It's like they gave us like video games, which have zombified generations of people.
Yeah. And see, again, it's like it's just a testament to how willing we are to give ourselves over to just really good soft power, right? So soft power being like the idea that it's like you're using culture to influence people as opposed to hard power, which is like actual like military diplomatic relations, that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and again, I don't know if there's anything malicious behind that other than like the general maliciousness of capitalism. You know,
probably that's probably,
you
it.
Know, it's like, I don't think like, you know, there's Japanese businessmen sitting around like, haha, we're going to take over America through video games. You know, but it's just because of that. And all of a sudden everybody like gets copies of these, you know, books on like the Japanese way of business. And this becomes a whole thing, you know, it's very like, that's very prominent in the beginning of this film. You know, that's kind of what it's about. I mean, we're still obsessed with it. Marie Kondo, that whole thing. It's like, you know, there's this sort of commercialization of Japanese ideology as if there is something like
transcendent about it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, but it's just, and again, we've been long fascinated by that. I think, you know, I mean, we joke on the show all the time about Memoirs of a Geisha, but like, that's a real thing, like a real allure, you know, to Japan, you know, this like that Japan as a whole is this like mysterious woman that knows all these ancient secrets and things. And, you know, and we're just,
but it's hiding behind her fan.
Right. Exactly. You know,
bashfully looking at us.
So it's just, just a very interesting dynamic that, that happened in really what is a very short period of time, you know, from being like so terrified of the Japanese to now like lusting after their business secrets and, you know, their
way of life
games and their exactly. And their, this way of life, you know, it's just anything like Eastern, you know? So I just thought that was an interesting point that you made right at the beginning. You're like, ah, it must be the '80s. There's the Japanese.
I'm sure, listener, you didn't think that this is where this was going, where this like, you know, 20 minute long conversation about like Japan in the '80s.
There are lots of articles and things out there about this, so people can certainly go and look. There was I was looking Fascination. Well, I'll try to look for it and post it in. There was like a whole paper written about, or no, it's a book all about Japan and the U.S. and this fascination with culture and kind of the significance of that. But
yeah, and this is all in the first 15 minutes of the film, y'all. So like, buckle up.
It just sets the tone.
And then again, the 80s fascination with like Latin culture, with like the steamy salsa bar scene where, you know, they're having their, you know, they're dancing the blambada, and he's just, you know, trying to keep up with her, and her sweaty perm is hitting him in the face, just, you know, beautifully dripping, like, you know, soul glow, but not, because it's just sweat. So
Sorry, I found it real quick. Consuming Japan, Popular Culture and the Globalizing of 1980s America. So there you go. It's a book. Andrew C. McKevitt wrote it. It's the foundation for some of like the article I was reading about those connections. But anyway, so moving on to the sex and the murder.
More sex and murder. So here we go.
Yeah. Did you like the film, Joe? What did you think overall?
Yeah, it was good. I mean, it's one of those films where like I liked it, but it's not a rewatch film for me. It's not like it would be a rewatch film if I was going to show it to someone who had never seen it before. But it's not like, oh, at my leisure, I would rewatch this again.
Yeah, it's not one that you just pop on for fun.
No.
I used to really like this movie, and when we first we used to throw a Bloody Valentine's party, I used to show it on the screen and had like a Bunny Boilers Unite kind of thing. But rewatching it again and in the years since, I really don't like this movie. I think it's a really harmful. I think it's very harmful. I think it has a lot of really bad messaging in it. It doesn't take away that I think that it's, you know, I mean, it was nominated for 6 Oscars, including Best Picture.
Yeah, I mean,
Best Actress to Glenn Close. There's a lot of great acting in it. you know.
The direction for the time is very good.
Yeah, yeah. The whole, like, there's so much really good, like, juxtaposition of thing and using, like, you know, where she lives, like, in this meatpacking district, and you just have this, like, sensual, raw nature that Alex gives off, that Glenn Close's character, Alex Forrest, you know, juxtaposed with, like, the meatpacking district and the steaminess and the, you know, just how
dirt and grit,
yeah,
and
gritty
flesh
it
and,
is exactly, yeah. You know, it's like, it's great. It's just this whole, you know, and then juxtapose that with like his family life in this beautiful New York apartment and like, you know, a nice like brick, you know,
brick building eventually to,
yeah, to moving to the country. And yeah, exactly. It's just, there's just a lot of nice work, yeah, with the scenery.
And not even really suburban, like fucking,
no,
straight
country.
Up country, like,
yeah, yeah,
country.
No, they go there. It's like the dream, you know. It's like, yeah, you know, oh, we've made it out of the city, and now we'll commute to work from our country estate.
Is it bad that the whole time I kept thinking, like, wow, his commute's gonna be shit?
Right. Yeah, it was like amazing how quickly they're all getting out, you know,
I
back
was
and
like,
forth.
I mean, like, I know it's the 80s, but yeah, it's pretty.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not
it's
sure.
It's not like they're moving to Brooklyn or anything. Like, they moved to, like, upstate.
Yeah, it's, yeah, very.
Or, like, Long
woody.
Island or something, yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah, so it's not, like, the technical stuff about the film or anything like that. It's just that now, you know, working in, like, the field I work in and rewatching the film today, it's just I feel so, like, I feel a lot of, like, anger on Alex's behalf and, you know, of, like, she needs help, you know.
Yeah.
And nobody in the movie is really trying to get her the help that she needs. You know, least of all, you know, Michael Douglas's character.
Yeah.
You know, he just wanted, you know, to have a little bit of fun. And she even says that, you know, Dan, his name's Dan, you know, that it's like you were only worried about you having a good time, you know, not even about necessarily her having a good time.
Well, yeah, because it's from his gaze, right? So,
right.
But then the conversation, right, in the restaurant, it's like, I can be discreet. Like, she kind of already set it up, like, you know. I mean, also, she's saying what she needs to say in order to close,
right,
the deal. Yeah, I mean, again, like, there's no denying that this woman is in desperate need of some, you know, a medical professional.
Right.
let's just put that out there. Let's also, you know, I'm glad. I'm wary of using the word crazy because that's,
right,
you know, it's such a pejorative, especially in this particular sense. I mean, it's just, you know, she's mentally ill. She needs help.
Yeah, something that's not really addressed. I mean, they call her, you know, a crazy bitch, you, yeah, know, and all of that in the film. But they, yeah, it never addresses, like, what's really going on with her. You know, I mean, it's just, it changes from, starts out as a film about an affair, you know, that's, you know, more intense than obviously he signed up for, but then it kind of becomes like a slasher film.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know,
then he like gets stalked and it's all very, and the thing is like, it's all very realistic. Like it's,
oh,
very,
yeah,
like from the sex and, you know, the sink and the, he can't get his pants off his almost dropping her. And
you know, that's one of my favorite things about the movie is like the realism of that. Like, you know, we were talking about it when that scene was going on, because it feels very real. Like, I think anybody who's had sex has had, like, you know, those things where it's like you're just so turned on and like so just hot for each other that you're just pulling clothes off and things are falling and, you know, and like the water turns on and all the dishes are rattling and there's just something very visceral about that scene.
Yes.
You know, I mean, at least for me. I don't know, maybe.
Well, I was going to say, I'm like, for some people, yes. For me, I'm very, like, as being a large person, I'm very aware of what I may or may not hit at, like, in the middle, you know, in flagrante.
What doesn't even have to be at the sink. It could be in other areas.
That's true. You know. But I just, you know, I also don't like to make too big of a mess.
I see.
I mean, just because you have to clean it up eventually.
I don't know. Just, I was talking to somebody else, and they were talking about, like, you know, they had brought their boyfriend somewhere and just, you know, they had sex in a stairwell.
Yeah.
You know? And I was just, well, maybe, I was like, that's like, I thought it was kind of romantic, like in a way of like, just like a cute, it was a man and a woman.
Okay.
Yeah, not that I guess that should change.
Listen, you didn't
I do
see the face that I made when it was like romantic sex in the stairwell. Joshua also thinks The Fly is romantic. But I mean,
yeah.
I just, as a large person, I just could never, like, conditions have to be just right.
Right. Okay, well, hey, you know, and I obviously hear that. I hear what you're saying.
I hear you. I acknowledge you. I take it in.
You know, but I'm just.
But it is realistic, very realistic.
Yeah, I really like it because it's clumsy and it's fun and they're laughing and they're just like in this early beginnings of this, you know, it feels so, you know, just fun and frivolous, you know, and obviously because we have no idea what's, well, if you're seeing this for the first time, you have no idea what's to come, you know.
Can I just say that, like, they really gave him no motive. Like, he didn't seem. No reason to cheat. Like, there was no, like, he didn't look like he was disaffected. He didn't look like, he just looked like he was just living his everyday life and this opportunity presents itself and he just went for it.
Yeah.
But there was no, like, you know, usually there would be some sort of, like, musical leitmotif of him, like, you know, being, like, sad, having into the same routine or whatever.
Right.
And they kind of gave that because, yeah, he is a family man with a pet and a young child living in an apartment in New York. So there's all of that. But he just, it didn't seem like, I'm like, he just ruined a perfectly good thing.
Well, but that, and that's what kind of feeds it. That's why I have so many problems with this movie, especially now that I have a different viewpoint of it than mm-hmm. I did when I first saw it years and years ago. But, you know, it's like this, like, morality tale. It's like, you know, mm-hmm. how, like, he goes off and has this affair and, like, you know, pays for it in this massive way, you know, because it's like, this could happen to you, fellas. Like, you know, be careful where you stick it, you know, because women be crazy.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like... And I was reading some stuff from the director of how, like, he said he's been approached throughout his life where men are like, oh, you saved my marriage, or, like, oh, that movie scared the shit out of me. Like, you know, oh, I should be, like, really, that's why you should be faithful to your wife, because you might meet some bunny boiler.
Yeah.
You know? And again, I mean, I've talked about it on the show. I don't necessarily have any real feelings towards, like, monogamy or things like that. I mean, when you're adults, like, you know, you should have adult conversations and, you know, whatever, to each their own. Within figuring that out. But obviously in this film, it's presented they're in a monogamous relationship. He shouldn't be going out and stepping out on his wife like that. And here is, you know, it's just painting this picture of... Because the thing is, the movie makes Alex the villain.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's where I really struggle with it and seeing this as some, like... great film that should be nominated for awards. And, you know, I mean, it could be a lot better. We could be having a better conversation about mental health and relationships and the dynamics of sex and of marriage, you know. But instead, mm-hmm. it's like, you know, she's this villainous monster, you know, who's
yep.
killing rabbits and, you know,
hurting herself,
which is actually far more realistic in the end, yeah. you know, than her trying to kill anybody else. Especially, so a lot of times, and I brought this up at work that we were going to do this film, and to one of the psychologists, and he goes, "Oh, he's like, that's such a great like representation of borderline personality disorder," and I'm like, you know. True, I guess if you look at it that way. And then as I'm researching, it does get brought up that this is used along with some other films to demonstrate like some of the features of borderline personality, which is this like intense, you know, back and forth, you know, where she's like she loves him and then he's like trash and she's sending him stuff and then like, you know, he shows up and she's all calm and like, what was, you know, like, what's wrong with you? Why are you so angry? You know, like everything's fine. You know, this is sort of the back and forth that she acts. But again, nobody brings up mental illness. We don't get any look into her background or why she's this way. Glenn Close did a lot of research, and that was the thing. Because we watched an alternate ending that, you know, because
yes.
So the movie ends very slasher like, where she kind of attacks the mother and, or, you know, the wife and Archer's character and Beth, you know, attacks her with the knife and this whole thing. And it's very, you know, horror movie where Dan comes in and drowns her in the tub, or so we think. And oh, there she is. She pops back up, just like Jason, you yes. know, exactly. And Beth shoots her with a gun, you know, saving the family, which she said she'd do. You know, she said that on the phone, like, if you come near my family again, I'll kill you. And it's like, you know, restores order, you know, and then is hugging her husband. It's like, oh my gosh, I'd be so balls out angry with him. Like,
because he is the one who invited
he brought
this.
All of this on them, yeah. You know, but he's the happen. Victim throughout it. And he's the, you know, like the good guy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so insane to me. So anyway, so we watched the alternate ending, which, you know, did not do well in test screenings, where, you know, he leaves her after that final confrontation they have where she, you know, has the knife in her kitchen at her apartment. And he leaves her and goes back home to his family. And then the cops show up and, oh, you know, she's dead and we think you murdered her. And we find out that she committed suicide and kind of in a last, you know, a final twist, you know, she, because he had touched the knife, his fingerprints are on it and she uses it to frame him for her own, for her suicide as a murder. And that was the ending that Glenn Close wanted. It does make sense given the nature of this, of the disorder. If we're saying that that's what she has, borderline, they do tend to self-harm a lot. And, and because of recent, like, you know, well, no, never mind. That's probably not what I want to say. Anyways, I know people with this disorder who have committed suicide, or have completed, who have died by suicide, mostly because of, like, accidental, you know, because it's like they try so many times that, of course, it will stick, you know. Just, you know, by, it's what happens. So that's the ending that was the original ending and that Glenn Close wanted to be the ending. And then I guess she fought them for weeks on what we saw, what the actual theatrical ending was, because she felt like she had done all this work and it didn't make any sense. And, you know, she sees Alex as, you know, she's not a villain. She's a very disturbed woman who has been taken advantage of by this guy and then, yeah, ditched. And even though she knows, quote unquote, and agrees to engage with that, she's probably not, she's not really, shouldn't be making that kind of decision.
Yeah.
You know? But
she ends up being the one who's villainized. But again, in terms, in the context of, like, the current society then, and then also current society now, she is the villain.
No, yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, I'm not saying, like, I mean, she does horrible things. She murders the rabbit, and that's awful. And, you know, kidnaps their child. I mean, she does a lot of things. But, again, it's like, I don't know how much of that it would be indicative of, like, the sort of mental illness that, you know, they're saying that she has. So instead it just, it does become a film. So if we just take it, obviously, just at the surface level for what it is, it is about, like, you know, a woman who goes out of her way to make this guy's life miserable.
Also, she, like, I like that they don't entirely, for at least to me, it didn't seem that they entirely confirmed that she was pregnant.
No, that's another interesting aspect of it. And I don't know. I don't know. I don't know what I mean. I always have felt when I've seen it in the past that I don't think she's actually pregnant. I think she's using it.
Yeah, for sure.
As a way to keep in contact with him. And again, that's not entirely outside of the realm of possibility with, you know, certain mental states where people will make up things. She has that whole, I mean, I think that we're supposed to doubt her because of the beginning, you know, early on in the film when, you know, he has that little moment they're playing in the park and he, like, falls down and, you know, it's like he's had a heart attack or something and she runs up to him and then she's like, you know, my father died of a heart attack. And it's this whole, like, scene where, and then she laughs like, haha, gotcha. And then later on we find out that her father really is dead, but from something else. So it's like, I think we are supposed to doubt her, you know, her credibility. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I mean, what I think is that contraception is the responsibility of both partners and not necessarily not necessarily one person or the other.
No, I agree.
Well, in this context, it is not primarily the responsibility of the woman to be taking birth control. He should have also wrapped that shit up.
Yeah, the whole thing of him like, oh, you're not on anything? It's like, no, you know, I don't go around, or I mean, according to her, you know, she doesn't go around just sleeping with any old person, you know. But ideally, he doesn't either, you know. I mean, we're not, but again, we're not given much information. Neither of them. We're not given much motive behind either their actions.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, is it is it, you're already having like illicit sex. Of course, you're going to be like raw dogging all over the fuck, the meatpacking district. You know what I'm saying? Like, so.
Well, yeah, maybe. Yeah. I was going to look, I was reading this Mental Health America, Mind Over Pop Culture, Fatal Attraction. So it kind of just, you know, says a little bit of what we're talking about. The movie is in a weird place in history. It received 6 Oscar nominations, including Best Picture, and is generally considered a classic. It's also quite often used in classrooms to illustrate borderline personality disorder. It's also one of the highest profile movies with a person with a mental health condition and one who is successful and glamorous, which is interesting.
Yeah.
That is true. She is, you know, she's out there living her life. She's beautiful, looks happy, you know,
has
but
this, you know,
is struggling.
Really, like, you know, lovely apartment.
Oh, yeah, her apartment
she
is cool.
She's cultured and, yeah. You know.
Yeah, she loves Madama Butterfly.
Yes, she loves Madama Butterfly.
But it says Alex is also the villain in the movie because of her mental health condition. Everything she does seems to stem from it. Her actions are used to illustrate borderline personality disorder because they follow the textbook symptoms so completely. Her story arc mirrors the slasher movie villains of the time, right down to the he's not dead jump at the end. So this is taking this whole little article is taking the position that, you know, this movie is offensive, you know, to people with mental health conditions. Cause no one in no time in the movie does anyone think to get her help. Even when she attempts suicide, his thing is to hang out with her.
I thought that was very strange. It's just like, I was like, she's like, why not get her help? Why not, you know, get her a hold.
Well, because he doesn't want to risk his own.
Yeah. Again, it's about keeping up the lie.
Yeah, so that's the thing. Like, you know, that should be like, yeah, oh, shit, warning. You know, like, I made a mistake, fine. You know, like, he could talk to his wife about that and move on. But, you know, then we wouldn't have a movie.
Well, and then the other thing is, like, when the next morning she's, like, you know, there and her wounds are starting to heal. You see the blood on the wrists. And, and he's all like, hey, I gotta go, though. It's like, I still gotta go. Like, yeah. I just, you know, you gonna be okay? And he's like, yeah, it's fine. I'm like, that's
yeah,
not good
no, it's
still.
Very, yeah, it's very, it's just sad, you know. And I think that happens a lot. And you know, that's kind of the scary thing about borderline personality disorder. And like, you know, we have clients that you know have this condition and are working, you know, through it. But they kind of do the same thing sometimes on the phone with us, you know, like. They'll call, and so I have experiences like talking to people in this way where they call and they're very calm and nice and they call again and I'm like this horrible thing, and you know, and all of us are, you know, I hate all of you and all of my doctor's awful and everybody's awful, and then the next time I see them it's like, hello, how are you doing, I love coming here, you know. And so it's very terrifying because they're very sick. It's a very sad disorder to have, because it comes with all this fear of loss and of abandonment issues and things that, you know, really awful things that probably happened to them, you know, in their childhood and in those early relationships, along with, you know, whatever chemical things are going on. But it causes people to be very emotionally exhausted by them. And it's very easy to give up on people with this disorder because and that's a self-fulfilling prophecy for them, because that's the whole thing is nobody cares about me and everybody leaves me. And it's like, well, because you're very intense, you know, the feelings and the exhaustion that people have.
And then people go into, like, you know, that fight or flight mode. They start to protect themselves. And the only way sometimes to protect yourself is to extricate yourself from the situation.
Is to get out. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's unfortunate. And again, I've been in some situations here that, you know, taught me a lot about, you know, trying to help. You know, it's like, you know, you do have to call emergency services. You do have to call professionals. You do have to get people in to help. And if the person refuses that, then you have to, you know, take care of yourself.
Yeah.
You know, I do get the need for that, you know, but it's just, it's a very sad situation. So when watching this movie again today, I just thought about those clients that are suffering with this. I think about family members of mine who have this. And I just think, you know, it's just very, very sad, you know, because the symptoms of it and the things that it causes her to do in the context of the film, you know, make sense. They make the situation far worse, obviously. And then it's kind of the, you know, the back and forth between them. It's like, I get why, you know, he's not you know, what are they, equipped, you know, to use that word.
Oh,
he's not equipped to help this woman, you know, and she knows that, and that's not really the point, you know.
Yeah, he's,
it's just to be with someone.
Yeah, he kind of reminds me a little bit of Adam Driver's character in Marriage Story. Like, he's a little, like, self-involved, and only when the things that he cares about are threatened is when he is, like, proactively...
Yeah, and totally. I mean, you know, he's a rich, successful dude in the 80s. Of course, he's like white guy. You know what I mean? Yeah, he's got everything, and he's trying to get the best of both worlds. You know, so wife's away. Hey,
the first scene with the family, he's like working on something, but he's also like has his headphones on, like he's there with them, but not present. Yeah. So he's already like, you know, that's a nice little signal of what foreshadowing of what's going to come.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, again, I mean, I think this is, you know, another movie that has had a massive effect on culture. I mean, it created a whole word, a bunny boiler. Like, we all know what that means, you know. I don't know if it's as in fashion as it was.
I don't think I've ever heard it before. Oh, okay. I know, I mean, again, having not seen the film all the way through, but I know the references.
Yeah.
And then,
well, it's an archetype, you know, it's like like the, you know, a hag, the horror hag thing, or hagsploitation, or, you know, the bunny boiler.
Yes, because there have been several films where this happens. And...
Yeah, I think Audition is one where I think has an obvious influence from Fatal Attraction.
A very obvious, just even from like them in the bedroom and Alex's room is very heavily influenced in the location where they go during the fever dream.
Yeah.
And you have like, oh God, what is that? Obsessed, I think, is the one with Ali Larter and Beyonce and Idris Elba. So, you know, all of that. And then that one has like, you know, a racial component to it as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, so like the idea of like the bunny boiler, my reference that I finally understood is there, they kind of did something similar on an episode of Family Guy.
oh, I love you, Joe.
Yeah, I know. So like Meg is the, Meg is the Alex Forrest character. So she's like turning a lamp on and off, like holding Brian's collar and also, you know, talking about how like he... Like, she makes him a pie, and it has some of her hair in it. And then she's basically emulating what Alex says on the thing about, like, there's growing inside of me. You are growing inside of me. I feel you. I taste you. All of that stuff. And I'm like,
I kind of want to see that episode now because I don't watch Family Guy, but I would like to just see, just to see the reference.
Oh, it's pretty great.
That's pretty funny. It's just, you know, again, bunny boiler. It's just, I don't know, because of this film... It's like, it's a way to blame women for like bad behaving men. You know, it's like, you know, guys go and do all this stupid bullshit. And then when women get angry, it's like, oh, you're crazy. You know, it's like.
No, he probably shouldn't have been an asshole.
And, like, I think there's some responsibility here in the conversation. Now, again, in the context of the film, it is what it is. You know, you watch it, you see her as like, she's just some psychotic person that's out there who is, you know, wreaking havoc on the life of this one guy, you know, if you just take it simply as that. But on the other hand, it's like so many people saw this movie, they loved it, they wanted to give it awards, and you know, you have this person who is severely hurting, and people probably recognize her in their life. They probably are sitting there like, oh my God, you know, that's just like blah blah, or that's just like this person or that person, you know. And so it becomes this like mental illness is this villainous thing that, to quote the rest of this article, we've enshrined mental illness as a villainous thing, a trait that belongs to people who need to be killed by good people. Like, yeah, that's a horror film right there. You know, that's you know, and again, very successful, huge movie. Lots of people saw it. And that's, if that's what they walk away with, is seeing like somebody, you know, struggling through this, like, let's kill her, you know?
Yeah, or let's kill her because she has crossed the bounds of like conformity. She's crossed the disrupted the conventions of our normality.
But that's the thing. It's like if they had kept the original ending where she kills herself, it may, you even said it when we watched it, you're like, well, it doesn't have the same punch. And I think that's exactly what happened. And I think there was a quote from the director or producer, somebody, of like, if we'd kept the original ending, the film has quote unquote blue balls. Like it does. There's not this like, you know, we need to see something bad happen to this woman, you know, who is obviously very sick, who is obviously, you know, going through something and needs help. Police, you know, he, you know, the responsible thing would have been to be like, I fucked up. I got to call the police. This could have all been avoided, you know, early on in the film. But instead it goes on and on because of, you know, the reasons that we've discussed. Yeah. You know, so they want to have this bloody moment where she's punished, you know, for being sick, for being ill.
Yeah. When you put it that way, it really doesn't make me like the film either.
Yeah. I mean, that's what we're here to do, is just to you know, to interpret something, you know. And again, this is also kind of part of our ongoing conversation that we've had throughout this podcast of films like Split and films like, you know, well, we haven't done it yet, but we'll do it eventually, like Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, you know, movies where mental illness is depicted, and a Psycho, you know, that's one that we've done, you know, the irresponsible ways that mental health gets addressed in horror films. You know?
And it's that the problem is not the disease. The problem, again, it feels kind of like this, like late stage capitalist way of thinking about mental illness. You know what I mean? Where it's just like, oh, you know, these are things that happen, but people are still ultimately responsible.
Yeah.
In the same way that like we choose to society as a whole, some people in society choose to disregard circumstances and how institutions oppress, but you know, like let's still stop and frisk people in black neighborhoods, but let's not examine the larger ways that reasons why, you know, why there is a preponderance of crime in those areas because of the institutions that have kept people in poverty.
Right.
So again, instead of having the larger conversation about what's at stake, we reduce it to individual responsibility and every, you know, bad people. I just keep thinking, I'm just going to that idea of like, you know, if you won't go to jail if you haven't done anything bad. And I'm like, well, no, that's not true. That's not necessarily true. Innocent people go to jail all the time.
Yeah.
Just like in this situation, it's just like, oh, it's, you know, it's her mental illness. It's like, we're afraid of saying it's of absolving someone because of mental illness, but we're also not willing to deal with the fact that once we identify that there is the illness, we're not going to get them help or do anything that's going to help treat that.
Right, because their symptoms create inconveniences in our lives. Now, I mean, it grows obviously here to, you know, murderous rage. Again, not a likely path for somebody with this particular disorder, but regardless, this is film. This is how they choose to show this one particular person. But that's the thing. Again, then we pull that out and it gets applied to everything. So you think you upset a woman and you think, oh my gosh, she's going to murder my dog. That's like, you know, it's like,
well, yeah,
that becomes a cultural conversation.
Exactly. As opposed to like, don't do shitty things that can upset people. Like,
right. And have more, you know, everybody should be more responsible for mental
health. Dan really had no reason to go and do any of what he did. No.
Well, and that was the thing, like, you know, we were talking about that because Ann Archer, obviously, she's a gorgeous woman. You know, Beth is, you know, by all standards, you know, what you're saying, like, because of the visual language of movies, you know, and the whole way that stories are told, you know, she's there, looking gorgeous, looking like, you know,
there's no reason for her to be, there's no reason for him to be like, you know,
in the way that we're taught to think, you know, if she had been frumpier or, you know, if they had chosen, you know, if the kid was screaming, if there were things that were cluing us in.
Exactly. If he like had some sort of hardship that he's trying to escape from.
Right.
And again, like it was just, he just did it just because it was there, because he could.
Because he could. And I think that's, again, that goes back to the complicated morality of this movie of like, you know, if he would have just kept it in his pants and went home to his wife instead, you know, but he brought this on himself and this is what happens.
But that's horror, right?
Right.
Like that's horror morality is something that like, you know, again, Midsommar, right? Just because he was like, you know, emotionally abusive and mildly shitty to her, like, did that mean that he needed to be, does that mean that he needed to be burned alive inside the bear carcass?
Right.
Again, like.
Of course.
Yeah. Yeah. But, yeah. But these are.
We don't want to suck all the fun out of these.
Yeah,
kids.
Exactly.
Anyways. Yeah. So I'm really glad that we did this movie. I'm glad that we watched it. I don't always think of it as a horror film, but watching it again today, I'm like, no, it totally. It's such a slasher film.
Yeah.
It's such a, it's very dramatic, and the music and everything, and it's very operatic. Again, why I kind of would have liked to have seen that kind of ending, the original ending. Maybe they could have punched it up a little bit more, made it, more dynamic, just because the whole connection with Madame Butterfly and how she's in love with this man, and then he abandons her and she commits suicide. Like that. I mean, that whole like
there's definitely a way. Like if they ever choose to reboot this and remake it, there is a way that you could have done the original ending, because where I thought it was going to go was I thought it was going to be something along the lines of like her final act against him was to frame him for her, like that's the, like to frame him for her murder.
Yeah, so you felt that naturally.
I was like, oh, okay, so like that makes sense. It's like it's going to be like it's going to be her final act, and like basically everything in death she'll know that he gets to rot, kind of thing. I thought that's where it was going, because that would also be a little bit more like a little bit more individual responsibility as opposed to reacting to mental illness.
Right. Yeah.
To me.
Yeah. Yeah. And it keeps that arc.
Yeah.
You know?
But like, yeah, I mean, the way that they ended it with like the recording and all that stuff, and it's not entirely sure if that's a new recording or the same. You know what I mean? Like. Is it the
oh,
same
in the alternate ending with the tape, because the wife finds the tape. Yeah, yeah. Which you can find on YouTube, dear listener, if you've seen Fatal Attraction or if you're watching it for the first time before listening to this.
I like how Adrian Lynn just says, like, here's the alternate ending. You can see if you like it or not.
Yeah.
make up your own mind.
Yeah, but again, I think audiences at the time, they just really wanted to see her punished. And, and again, it feeds into all of that, women and, crazy women, deserve punishment. So...
Yeah.
Well, all right. I'm glad you did. You did enjoy it, at least.
I did enjoy it,
but you're not rushing out to watch it again.
No, and again, like I think this conversation is very. I think having this conversation is very important. Where we, again, because like we're not here to suck the fun out of everything, but we are. We have to, knowing what we know, we have to do better. Right? We have to at least be open to the conversation.
Yeah. They could, this film could be made again today and be a little bit more responsible, I think, and be a little, and have more of a conversation. Maybe we could have gotten a little bit more backstory, a little bit more, because like in Audition, that she was like horrifically abused by her uncle.
Yeah. And that's part of.
And that's part of what's going on with her. And again, and she kind of has the same borderline. I mean, if you believe the narrative of the film, because obviously it has the fever dream issues, of what's real and what's not real. But regardless, if you follow that plot, it's very similar. They could have had the same thing. And I think there's an interview or one of the things I was reading that Glenn Close was told by a psychiatrist, because there's the whole scene where she's watching the family eat,
and then
she throws up, that they were tying that to probably some horrific abuse in her childhood, that the idea of a happy family makes her violently ill. For longing, but also of like, that's absolutely not what she had, which I thought was kind of an interesting reading, but we don't get that in the film.
No,
you don't get that.
And you also get
story.
Violently ill at the thought of a happy family. Don't you?
I do as well. Yeah. It's disgusting. Yeah. And on that note, Joe, I love you, man. I hope that you have a great rest of your week.
Thank you.
And,
we'll be back.
We'll be back
very soon.
Yay!
Fright School is produced by Joshua Napier and Joe Farron.
Our intro was edited by Davey Boy Productions.
Our logo was designed by Jamie Channel Guzman.
Episodes are edited and engineered by Joe Farron.
Fright School is produced in terrifyingly beautiful San Diego, California.
Ha 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 ha!